Josh Chin is the Deputy Bureau Chief in China for The Wall Street Journal. Lisa Lin covers data use and privacy for The Wall Street Journal from Singapore. Together, Lisa and Josh are the authors of Surveillance State, Inside China's Quest to Launch a New Era of Social Control. They join me today to talk about that book. We'll be right back with that discussion after a quick break. I'm Michael Morrell, and this is Intelligence Matters. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Intelligence Matters ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
This spring, if you'd rather spend time enjoying your lawn instead of trying to keep it alive, there's good news. TruGreen is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and even some things you might not even think of. They'll do all of it, while you can do literally anything else. With True Green, you could have your lawn looking as good as a putting green. That's not hyperbole. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. True Green offers a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people guaranteed.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about all from the comfort of your home isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Lisa, Josh, it is great to have you on Intelligence Matters. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Thank you for having us.
So you guys are the authors of a terrific book. It's called Surveillance State, Inside China's Quest to Launch a New Era of Social Control. Congratulations on the book. I read it from cover to cover. I found it interesting. I found it insightful. I found it readable and more than a bit scary. I'd like to start by asking you guys how you define a surveillance state, right? How do you think about it in terms of a definition?
Yeah, so, you know, I think the way we thought about a surveillance state is a state in which governance, the sort of act of managing society, is sort of driven by and really indivisible from advanced surveillance technologies, where and you see this really clearly in China, where the Communist Party there has sort of melded its traditional approach to governing and controlling China with cutting edge technologies like facial recognition, techniques like data mining, in order to sort of create a kind of more nimble form of authoritarianism.
It's interesting that you talk about, you know, advanced surveillance technologies, because one of the questions I wanted to ask is how does surveillance in China today compare to, you know, old Mao style surveillance, right, where neighbor was spying on neighbor? How do you think about that?
Right. You know, I mean, it's interesting. When we started looking into this, is, you know, one of the things we discovered was that, you know, really, I mean, just to a certain degree, all states are surveillance states, going back to the beginning of states, right? In the sense that anyone who's trying to govern a large number of people needs to have information about those people in order to govern them, right? There's a James C. Scott sort of famously described this as rendering societies legible, right? So this has been, you know, all the way back to the Romans, you know, conducting surveys so they knew who to tax and who to draft for the Roman legion. You know, it's as old as time, basically. But, I think in the 20th century, what you started to see with Mao and with other sort of totalitarian leaders was this sort of utopian idea, right? This idea that you could collect enough information to sort of mold society in a scientifically ideal way, right? You know, I think the difference between what Mao was sort of aiming for and the types of information he was collecting and what you see now is mostly a difference in sort of volume and value of data collected, right? Like Mao, obviously he was limited to sort of human data collection. So he had a lot of human spies. He had this vast sort of domestic spying network, hundreds of thousands of people. And of course, it was encouraging other people to, regular people, to inform on each other and that sort of thing. And the Communist Party now, I mean, they still do some of that, but they have these other just vastly more powerful tools that are so much more efficient at collecting and analyzing information. And so they just have the ability to sort of consider this utopian project of engineering society in a way that Mao never actually really could.
I guess to add on to that, you know, the intent for China to surveil its citizens was always there. But what we really saw in the last kind of 10 to 15 years was the ability, because there's been huge advances in technology. For example, the advent of deep learning and the realization that you had these fast processing chips that could crunch that data in a very efficient manner. So crunch down large amounts of data and draw analysis from that data, as per what Josh mentioned, that really actually spurred the development of China's modern day surveillance state.
Okay, guys, what are the key components of the surveillance system in China? How do you think about that?
So I would probably characterize, to me, the way China's surveillance state stands out is in two areas. One is the breadth of the data collection. And when we talk about the breadth of the data collection, I refer you to the amount of like touch points where the Chinese government can actually extract data from its citizens. So the Chinese government has access to probably about 400 million cameras across the country. And I think the difference between China and many other countries is that all these cameras are largely state-owned. Unlike in the US, where you have a ton of Amazon Ring cameras that are privately owned, you know, a lot of the surveillance cameras that you see on the street in China are owned by government agencies and largely by the Chinese police. And beyond access to that, those 400 million cameras, the Chinese government still has access to about a billion smartphones that the Chinese citizens use. And that's because there are a series of national security and intelligence laws that were put in place in China over the last decade that actually allowed the Chinese government to have access to a lot of the information that Chinese tech companies collect. And the difference in China versus other countries is that a lot of citizens are largely reliant on Chinese apps, and in particular, this one app called WeChat, which is made by and run by a company called Tencent. And on this app, WeChat, it kind of functions quite similarly to a mesh of, you know, a Facebook, Instagram, a Google, and Amazon. And on top of that, you know, you layer on mobile payments. So the Chinese government, through this app, has the ability to figure out what its citizens are searching online, what they're saying online, what they're buying online, and where they're traveling. So there are a lot of these touch points in which the Chinese government could actually extract data from its citizens to just understand what's going on the ground. And add to that, you know, mobile phone trackers. And right now, you know, right over the last 2 years of COVID, we've definitely seen the Chinese government improve in its ability to collect data on where your smartphone has been. So, for example, a lot of the COVID health codes that China has been using over the last 2 to 3 years, which have been tracking your position and where you've been going in the last 2 weeks just to ascertain if you're a health risk, that's an additional layer of data that the Chinese government now has. Like the ability to collect on all its citizens in real time. China really stands out for the breadth of the data collection and its ambition. So its ambition really is the second reason why we see China as such a standout. Now, undoubtedly, China is probably the only country out there that hopes to use surveillance to create this techno-utopian state. And as we mentioned in our research and in the book, you know, China has this ambition to use the data collected to analyze any future threats to its governance and to identify these threats quickly and do something about it, to create some sort of an alternative model to what democracy could offer. Because as a country itself, an authoritarian country does not have the same democratic institutions that, you know, developed Western countries do.
So Lisa, that's a tremendous amount of data you just talked about, right? And then earlier you talked about the use of AI, machine learning, right, to do something with that data, right, to that would allow the Chinese government to take actions that they think are necessary to protect the state. Can you talk a little bit more, guys, about how they actually use AI, how they use machine learning? I think that would be insightful.
I think probably the most vivid example in China, and it's one that the listeners of this podcast probably have heard of, is Xinjiang, which is a remote region far northwestern China on the doorstep of Central Asia. And Xinjiang stands out because it's home to a large population of Turkic Muslims, including the Uyghurs, who have always chafed at Communist Party and at Han Chinese rule. And so there's always been a lot of conflict out there. And in recent years, the Communist Party has, their solution to that has been to roll out what I think is probably the closest thing we've ever gotten to a sort of truly dystopian, you know, sort of Orwellian surveillance state, right? And what they've done is they've gone out and you know, blanketed the entire region. I mean, it's twice the size of Texas. It's a massive place. But they've blanketed the entire region in cameras, in microphones, other sorts of sensors, security gates, to the point where if you're a Uyghur moving around in Xinjiang, outside or even inside your home, basically everything you're doing is capable of being recorded and analyzed in real time. And so all these sensors feed this data into a centralized data platform. It was actually built by a defense contractor. And it's sort of modeled on systems that the U.S. military uses to coordinate complicated joint operations, like counterinsurgency operations. And so all this data gets sucked into the centralized platform, and then they use it there. So these cameras have, the sensors themselves have artificial intelligence built into them, you know, so the cameras can recognize people's faces, they can recognize people's voices, that sort of thing. And then all this data gets analyzed on this platform in ways that it's a bit of a black box. We don't know exactly how they calculate it, but they use this data to categorize people according to the level of threat the Communist Party perceives in them. So, you know, there's three categories. In one system that we looked at, there were three categories: unsafe, safe, and average. For people who were deemed unsafe, and that means, you know, they may have filled up their gasoline, they may have filled up their car with gasoline one too many times, or they may have a digital Quran on their phone, or they may be friends with the wrong people, or whatever sort of biographical markers the Communist Party is using. The people who have those markers, who are seen as unsafe, for a long time were being shipped off to a sort of gulag of re-education centers, basically.
Yeah. So it's your discussion of Xinjiang in the book that really makes this whole thing chilling. But there's a flip side to the coin, right? You tell another story about how these tools could actually be used for good. And I'm wondering if you can talk about that a little bit.
Sure. So Josh did a ton of the reporting in Xinjiang, and on my part, you know, I traveled to a lot of these wealthy Han Chinese cities that were located on the east coast of China. And in those wealthy cities, what you saw were the same systems, often built by the same manufacturers as well, that were used for oppression but in Xinjiang were used to make city governance a lot more efficient. So, for example, you know, the facial recognition that would possibly identify a security threat in Xinjiang would be used by the Chinese police to identify buckets of society that they deemed as people that could cause, you know, national instability or some harm. So people that the Chinese police would use facial recognition in the wealthier Chinese cities to identify would be ex-convicts, for example, or ex-convicts that were just released and they wanted to monitor just to make sure that they were settling back into society much better. And then other people that they would use these facial recognition systems and CCTV cameras to identify would be fugitives on the run or people that they knew were notorious drug pushers. So all these are kind of people that you really, as a normal, regular person, wouldn't be wanting to walk alongside on the street with. And it wasn't just identifying like people of interest as well. These same sensors that were sucking up video and, you know, car counts or number of people counts were used to identify traffic accidents really quickly to get first responders to the scene, for example. And we pull out a city in East China called Hangzhou. And Hangzhou might not ring a bell to most of your listeners, but the companies that are headquartered in Hangzhou probably would. So a company like Alibaba, for example, is headquartered in Hangzhou, and a company like Hikvision, which is the world's largest maker of CCTV cameras, they're also headquartered in Hangzhou. So for this, for these reasons, you know, the Hangzhou government just has tended to really try and lean towards making Hangzhou a smart city in the digital sense. They've been very embracing of using technology to run the city and using these companies as like partners. Hangzhou used to be the fifth most congested city in China, probably about 2 or 3 years ago. What the city government did was to put in place a system of CCTV cameras and sensors that were absorbing how many cars were on the street and using that to optimize traffic lights. So in periods of peak traffic, the traffic lights would stay green for cars a lot longer. And that kind of helped Hangzhou drop from fifth most congested to 57th most congested city in a matter of a couple of years. For a reporter that had been traveling in the region so frequently, I often went to Hangzhou for work. And if you were stuck in a Hangzhou jam, you would be stuck for 40 minutes and you'd be moving maybe a mile just because the Hangzhou road network was non-established and the subway system was very immature. And yet population and car population in particular probably doubled or tripled. So, you know, it was like small things like these that the city government have been using these surveillance systems to help just make life more frictionless. And I think the one example that really stood out to us in our research and reporting was when we found a guy whose mother had fallen into a river. They lived on the outskirts of Hangzhou City, but in that area, the Hangzhou government was still starting to put in place these systems. His mom had fallen into the river, and he was really lucky, and they were very lucky because a neighbor was around the corner and fished her out, but she still was in a condition where she needed medical help. So the nearest hospital had sent an ambulance over to get her. And once she was in the ambulance, the driver had turned on this system that allowed traffic lights and sensors to recognize its license plate. So, you know, the same sort of computer vision that's used in facial recognition in Xinjiang was used here to recognize the license plate of the ambulance and to turn all the traffic lights green from the point of picking her up to the hospital. So that shaved off half the time that it needed for her to get to hospital and to get treatment and to drain out her lungs. So in such a life and death situation, it really makes you wonder if such surveillance systems actually might have a use. And in the case of Hangzhou, a lot of people that we spoke to just felt like the positive externalities of having such a system outweighed any of like the data collection, the more sinister data collection kind of outcomes.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be right back with more of our discussion with Lisa and Josh.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
So guys, given that, right, in Han China, is there a resistance in general to the surveillance state, or is there an acceptance of it?
Well, you know, this is actually one of the most fascinating aspects of doing all of this work. And I think it's our understanding of change the most in looking at this, right? And I think as you start off, we started off like a lot of people, I think, do with the assumption in China that privacy actually doesn't matter that much. And in fact, if you look at the sort of official Chinese government-approved dictionary, the word for privacy doesn't appear there until the late 90s. So it is a relatively new concept. And I should say, you know, I think at least up until recently, a large number of people in China, the vast majority of them probably just didn't really have the luxury to be thinking about things like privacy. They're more, you know, there's more concern with putting food on the table. But in larger cities, as you know, as we sort of did more and more work and talked to more people, we realized, you know, in bigger cities with more educated populations, you do have the beginnings of a sort of privacy movement, right? A sort of understanding of privacy. And you had quite a few controversies actually involving big Chinese tech companies. One of them was Baidu, which is the Chinese equivalent of Google. And in one instance, the CEO had been at a forum and said, you know, we Chinese tech companies, we have a huge advantage because our customers don't care about what we do with their data. So we can do anything we want with it. And that spurred a huge backlash. And what was interesting is the way that the Chinese government handled this was, you know, you would sort of expect them, it's a country with this really extremely successful and powerful censorship apparatus, you would expect them to just use that to quash any talk of privacy. But actually what they did was a little bit of sort of jujitsu, right? Where they actually threw their support behind a lot of these controversies, and they sort of they had state media going after Chinese companies for mishandling customer data, and essentially put themselves on the side of the people and kind of defined privacy concerns exclusively in terms of what private companies did. Right. So the government use of data has never really, or at least again, not until recently, been scrutinized much in China. And now we've gotten to a really, really interesting period, which is, you know, anyone who's been paying attention to the headlines in China knows we recently had nationwide protests against the zero COVID regime that Chinese leader Xi Jinping had been promoting. And it's hard to overstate how surprising these protests were. I mean, this was the biggest demonstration of public defiance against the Communist Party since 1989, since the pro-democracy protests back then. And a lot of it, at the center of it, was this frustration with the controls that the Communist Party was imposing using its surveillance technologies. So I think we're at a new moment. It's actually, it'll be interesting to see how it plays out, because I think this is one instance in which the Communist Party may have overplayed its hand.
One of the things that I learned from the book was that China did not put this advanced surveillance system in place all by itself. It had some help, correct? And can you talk about that?
Sure. So what we found in our research is that the Silicon Valley has been there supporting the development of China's surveillance state right from its incubation. China's digital surveillance state, in its current form, really only started to take root at the turn of the century. So around year 2000, 2001, you saw the Chinese police a lot more willing to turn to digital technology to gather data. And when it did so, it ran these huge fairs, large expos in which it invited foreign companies to come down and to basically showcase their wares, just to allow Chinese police to have a look at what's out there and decide what they wanted to buy. And the companies that turned out at these exhibitions were all either pioneers of Silicon Valley or the who's who of the digital world at that point. So you saw people like Sun Microsystems come down. You saw Cisco attend the exhibition and showcase what they had to offer. You saw the now defunct Canadian company Nortel Networks come down. And there was also Siemens from Germany. And all these big companies were right there at the very first Chinese exhibitions, trying to sell things such as fingerprint database collection systems or other, you know, censorship systems like filters for the Great Internet Firewall. So we definitely saw like Silicon Valley play a very important role in the incubation of the early Chinese digital surveillance state. Fast forward two decades to present day, what you're seeing is Silicon Valley companies not just providing systems, they're actually providing components to the surveillance state. So if you think about the hard disk drive industry globally, it's really an oligopoly. The market share is mostly taken up by American companies such as Western Digital and Seagate. And these two companies have been known to be selling these hard disk drives to Chinese surveillance companies in large numbers, and even optimizing some of the hard disk drives as surveillance hard drives for the Chinese. And it isn't just like hard disk drives, you need the processing power as well. So chip companies like NVIDIA and Intel, they've been known to sell their GPUs and CPUs, these really high-end chips, to Chinese surveillance companies in order to power the data analysis that goes on the back end. So if you think about Silicon Valley involvement, it's huge. And not just in components, if you think about the financial aspect of things, a lot of US private equity companies and venture capital companies were the first companies to give Chinese surveillance startups like a leg up in the game by funding them. So there are a lot of ways that the West, and in particular the US, has contributed to the development of China's surveillance apparatus.
We're going to take another quick break. We'll be right back with more Intelligence Matters. Stay with us.
We all have busy lives these days, and we don't want to waste a day recovering after a night out. That's why ZBiotics is the answer we've all been looking for. Their probiotic was invented by PhD scientists to tackle rough mornings after drinking. Here's how it works. When you drink, alcohol gets converted into a toxic byproduct in the gut. It's this byproduct, not dehydration, that's to blame for your rough next day. Pre-alcohol produces an enzyme to break this byproduct down. This is a proactive solution that wards off feeling miserable the next day instead of a reactive approach like drinking electrolytes or eating greasy food. Enhance your mornings with ZBiotics. Go to ZBiotics.com/CBS to get 15% off your first order when you use code CBS at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. No questions asked. Remember to head to ZBiotics.com/CBS and use the code CBS at checkout for 15% off. Thank you, ZBiotics, for sponsoring this episode and our good times.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
I want to switch gears a little bit, guys, and talk about China's export of its surveillance system to other countries. The conventional wisdom, as you know, says that China wants to shape the world in its image, right, in its authoritarian image as a surveillance state, and you push back on that notion. Can you talk about that?
That view, this view of China sort of wanting to push its system on the rest of the world, I mean, it makes sense, right? The people who have that view, it's not coming out of nowhere, right? And you know, one of the pieces of evidence that people often cite is Xi Jinping himself, you know, China's leader. You know, he's talked about how, you know, China wants to make contributions to the sort of human pursuit of better governance systems and that sort of thing, right? And it's clearly, you know, diplomatically, it's spending a lot of capital, a lot of time trying to cultivate relationships around the globe. In some cases, you know, trying to co-opt global institutions like the WTO and WHO. But what we saw when we started looking deep into this, just in terms through the lens of exports of surveillance and this model that they have in particular of this sort of digital authoritarianism, is that it's more complicated, right? So they are definitely selling these technologies and these systems and the ideas behind them around the globe. We don't have really great data on this now, but the most recent number we have from a scholar at the University of Texas named Sheena Greetens, who dug around and found that there were at least 80 countries globally in the year 2020 who had imported state surveillance systems from China. And those range from authoritarian countries all the way to Western democracies, you know, local police stations in France and Germany and that sort of thing. One example that we saw sort of in detail was in Uganda, right? Which is one of these countries that sort of it kind of hovers between the United States and China. It maintains relationships with both. You know, it has, it's nominally a democracy, but the leader there, Yoweri Museveni, has won every election going back decades. And there are sort of course, allegations of election fraud and whatnot. China has been cultivating its relationship with Museveni for many years. And a few years ago, they sold him a sort of state surveillance starter kit, right? And they, you know, they flew Ugandan police out to China, to Beijing, where they were given lessons in how these systems are used. And, you know, just like China, the Museveni sort of initially said, oh, these systems are for fighting crime, but then quickly used them in sort of political ways to track opposition political figures. And so, you know, in some ways, what you saw in Uganda is that China is exporting its system. But the way that it was used in Uganda is not the way it's used in China, right? And that's partly because it can't be. China has all these advantages that a lot of other countries don't. You know, China has a lot of money. It has an immense, pretty well-trained, fairly tech-savvy bureaucracy. So, you know, it just a lot of countries really can't replicate China's model. And China, I think, realizes that. But what they're interested in is promoting this idea of governments being able to use these technologies in whatever way they see fit. Right. So the idea is not that they want to copy themselves around the world, but they just want to disrupt the sort of existing Western dominated order, which suggests that these state power should be restrained and individual rights protected against invasions of this kind. Right. They want to upset that conversation and make it okay for governments to use these technologies to control societies.
I want to ask you guys about the West's response to the rise of China's surveillance state and how well you think we've responded, and are there better approaches out there?
That's a great question, because in the last couple of months, we've definitely seen governments such as the US take action to stop the flow of the components that I talked about earlier into the Chinese surveillance state. So on October 7th, you saw the White House put out new export sanctions. And with these sanctions, with these regulations, they barred US companies from assisting in the development of China's advanced chip and semiconductor industry. And that meant if you were a US person or a US company, you couldn't be selling components, or you couldn't even be working or helping in any form. You know, US persons were not allowed to help with the development. One of the reasons cited was military. So they didn't want to empower Chinese military by helping with the development of high-end chips. But they also wanted to stop the expansion of the China surveillance state. And that was one of the reasons cited for these controls. So it definitely seen some steps being taken in recent months. And on how these steps actually play out in China, it's still a big question mark at this point. Because as with many export controls, you do see workarounds. And Chinese companies still can get these high-end chips in very small quantities. So when you think about like what governments are doing to stop the flow of either money or technology into the Chinese surveillance state, one company that often keeps coming up is a company called SenseTime. SenseTime really is China's largest AI unicorn. And I would say it was probably one of the startups that really made this idea of facial recognition, using facial recognition in solving crimes, really such a wide and global idea. So with SenseTime, what we saw was the US government put one of SenseTime's entities both on the entity list and the trade and on the investment blacklist. So if you were SenseTime's Beijing entity, you couldn't get chips from U.S. companies, you were on the entity list. And if you were SenseTime's Hong Kong entity, then you couldn't get any financing from U.S. investors. And SenseTime is this company that had been really funded by, you know, people like Fidelity, Qualcomm had a stake in it. So what the U.S. government had essentially tried to do was to restrict the flow of money or chips to SenseTime. But in reality, because of all these loopholes that I mentioned earlier, it didn't succeed. So with SenseTime, what we found out was when the company listed last year, 2020, in the Hong Kong Stock Exchange, it actually had a statement coming out saying that even though it was technically on the entity list, it was only one subsidiary of SenseTime that was on the entity list. it was its Beijing subsidiary. So its Shanghai subsidiary was free to buy whatever Intel and NVIDIA chips that they needed to power their surveillance systems. See, so the loophole that I talked about earlier, one of these legal loopholes is something like that. Just putting one subsidiary on the entity list wasn't enough. And SenseTime was also put on a Treasury blacklist at the end of 2021, which really barred U.S. investors from investing in it. But what you saw when it eventually went to IPO was there was still U.S. money in it. And that was because, and this is according to the company, that was because its Hong Kong entity was on that Treasury blacklist. But it was a Cayman Islands entity that was listed in Hong Kong. So there are all these ways that the U.S. has been trying to stop the flow or stop its companies and investors from aiding the development of surveillance in China. But really, there are some limitations.
The other plane on which this conversation exists is kind of just on the level of policy and ideology, actually, right? And so, you know, the real challenge for the U.S., completely apart from the technological question, is the appeal of this model, of the Chinese model, right? Which I think is, you know, around the globe, it's very simple, right? The Chinese government has this very simple message, which is that these technologies can be used to increase security and improve, you know, certain aspects of lives and, you know, in ways that we've never seen before. And they should just be, you know, everyone should be able to use them however they want. And the U.S. doesn't really have a good response to that, right? There's no sort of coherent Western vision or democratic vision of how these technologies should be deployed. And I think that's, you know, in part in the US, it's an issue. The US has always been schizophrenic about the role of technology and data in society, right? Especially, you know, since the rise of Silicon Valley, because, you know, Silicon Valley companies push this idea that it's the free flow of information that sort of gave rise to innovation in Silicon Valley. And so you can't cut it off, even though there are potentially, you know, bad side effects from having huge amounts of personal data floating around and being exploited by companies and governments. That's just the price you have to pay for innovation, right? That's the sort of US view of things. And the conversation hasn't really moved significantly beyond that. It has started to move beyond that in other places, in Europe, for example, in the UK, where, you know, you do have rules that are being implemented to really restrain some of the more invasive technologies like facial recognition, right? And where you have regulators whose job it is to sort of keep an eye on these sorts of things. But those are early days. And I think, you know, a lot of people feel that until the U.S. gets on board with it, you're really not going to have a compelling democratic alternative to the Chinese vision.
But we need one. We absolutely need one. The book is Surveillance State: Inside China's Quest to Launch a New Era of Social Control. The authors are Josh Chin and Lisa Lin. Josh, Lisa, thank you very much for joining us.
It was a tremendous pleasure. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you for having us.
That was Josh Chin and Lisa Lin. I'm Michael Morrell. Please join us next week for another episode of Intelligence Matters.
Intelligence Matters is produced by Olivia Gassis, Jamie Benson, Paulina Smolinski, and Reggie Bazile. For more from this week's show, visit cbsnews.com. Intelligence Matters is a production of CBS News.
I'm CBS News correspondent Major Garrett, host of the podcast Agent of Betrayal, The Double Life of Robert Hansen. During the Cold War, FBI agent Robert Hansen traded classified secrets to the Kremlin in exchange for cash and jewels. In the podcast, you'll hear from Hansen's closest friends, family members, victims, and colleagues for the most comprehensive telling of who Robert Hansen really was. Binge the entire series now. Agent of Betrayal, The Double Life of Robert Hansen is available on the Wondery app, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Hargan women seem to have it all.
From the outside looking in, we were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But as detectives would soon learn, there was a lot going on inside the Hargan household.
Ashley and I have been calling my mom and the house and Helen. No one's answering.
63-year-old Pamela Hargan gunned down in her own home. Her youngest daughter, Helen, lay dead upstairs.
Patrol, when they arrived, assumed or thought that there might have been a murder-suicide.
But for the detectives on the scene,
there were things about the scene itself that were concerning to us on day one.
Who would want to kill their mother and their little sister?
There is no boogeyman here. It is exactly who we think it is.
I'm Peter Van Sant from 48 Hours. This is Blood is Thicker, the Hargan family killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, the Hargan family killings, starting May 8th, wherever you get your podcasts.